But then there will be a day where you're like following a food stylist as they like create sci-fi food. And you're just like, this is ridiculous. What am I doing? And what are we all doing? But this is very cool, you know. And also like, you know, getting to be in production meetings and just getting to see like how different directors work and, you know, and how the crews interact and you know, how things are lit. Like and because I'm not present in doing that, like I don't have the stress of actually putting the light up. And my job is to watch and then film what I find interesting. It's like such an incredible kind of thing to just really take in exactly how a film set works.
Welcome to Filmmaking Framed, your video podcast uncovering the realities of filmmaking. I'm your host, Daniel Hughes.
And I'm your host, Tom Dexter. With us today is behind the scenes and EPK videographer, Alex Shipman. Alex has recent credits on Wonka, Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore, and Mickey 17. Welcome, Alex.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off. What is EPK? What does it stand for? And what do you do?
So EPK means electronic press kit. So it's a kind of old-fashioned term for what it all used to be. Like you'd go send out physical press packs that had like photos in them or photo books, things like that. But really now it's just classes like behind the scenes. So what I do is I film. I'm part of the publicity department and we create marketing material based on interviews and B-roll that I film on set. So I film the crew, basically make the film. So I'll be on set, but I'll also maybe go to costume departments, prop departments, people like building the sets, like every kind of, depending on what the project is, covering it from pretty much start to finish, like all the way to like scoring it and things like that. I'll get to film the orchestra. So that's the kind of overarching thing of what behind the scenes is. Yeah.
Wow. That's actually a role. It's a role I don't think many people are aware is there.
Mm.
And it's fantastic because you get to kind of see so many departments hard at work that you might not see. So if you're on set only, you might not see the prop store. And mm-hmm. if you're, you know, you wouldn't see post-production, for example.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, how do you get started in something like that?
Yeah, well, I actually did a traineeship. So there was a behind the scenes department traineeship. And I just thought it meant like not in front of camera. So I was like, yeah, I don't want to be in front of camera. So I want to be behind the camera. So I'll apply to that. And then I realized actually I was like behind the scenes documentary making, which was super interesting. But what I would say is it's, you know, because you're going into a set and you're like a department of one and you've got to navigate around lots of different people and really have an understanding, it's not a very good like entry level position. And I'd been working for a little bit before I went into that. So I would definitely say like, you want to build up some camera skills, you want to build up some confidence on set just as a runner and things like that. And then starting to look at different sort of publicity departments. So there's vendors that they're called vendors, which are basically like a production company for behind the scenes. So once you've sort of built some of those skills and done a bit of camera operating, have a showreel of yourself, that's when you can then start to get in contact with some of those guys. And then that's how you could progress into behind the scenes without the traineeship. Because I don't think there is really a behind the scenes training. I don't see it very often. I think I was very lucky just to sort of see it in that one moment that it was there, but I don't see it very often now.
Especially because you don't have a department, so you're the one carrying all the camera kit and setting all that up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was also lucky because that job was Star Wars, which it was just a humongous, like the behind the scenes department on that, we were like seven people because, wow, you know, there's just so much going on because it's Star Wars. Yeah. And they're doing everything practically. And so like, you know, something that would be CG maybe in another movie, they would spend months creating robots to be aliens and dressing them and testing them. So there's just lots to sort of film and build. And obviously, because it's so iconic as well. And it was the last in the big franchises, episode 9, there was just a lot to sort of cover. And they were really going for like a proper documentary, you know, as opposed to just like a featurette or something like that. So that's why it really worked, I think, as a traineeship in that one, is because there was actually a few of us there and things like that. So
forgive my ignorance. Can you define a featurette?
So a feature is Most of the time, it's just interviews with footage from the film. That's what a lot of them are. So interviews about what the cast think of their characters, what the director's vision was, you know, things like that with footage from the film. And it can also be B-roll from the set. It's a kind of like smaller 3 to 10 minute buzz piece, as opposed to a documentary, which is like an hour and a half making of. Or if you're Lord of the Rings, it's a 6-hour appendices. So yeah, that's the kind of different realms of EPK. It's featurette, doc, or appendices.
What sort of goes into the planning of it? Because it sounds like you're making a movie alongside the movie.
Yeah.
So presumably there's a lot of planning that goes into what you need, and you need to work out who's where when so that you've got the coverage so that you can get those featurettes together. Are you able to talk through what that planning process is like?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's like, with Star Wars, I would say we were like, there was a producer, there was quite a big team on that. So they look through the script and they see like what they think is going to be interesting to follow, you know, constantly talk. So actually as a trainee on that, I was ringing up the different departments and being like, what stage is this prop at now? Like what, you know, should we come along and cover this? Like when is your next makeup test? And then you sort of compile all of that and the producers sort of pick what they want. On smaller productions, it's literally sort of seeing what's going on a day-to-day basis and where we think we might go. I mean, there's a lot of the attitude of like, just try and film everything and then we'll kind of figure it out later a little bit. Say for like Wonka, there's one about like the world that the director built. So it's like, I think the feature on YouTube is called like Paul King's World or something like that. So kind of knowing that we're going towards that, you want to have like lots of interesting things of the sets. Lots, you know, obviously you will ask the actors and everything questions about what it's like working with the directors. So there's a little bit of planning going into that, but also kind of knowing that a lot of the time featurettes are about either the director or something like that. You kind of want to go in and film a lot of footage that can be used for it. So although there's not like a structure or a plan on films like that for exactly what you need to capture, you kind of, as you do the films, you kind of know what the editors will probably use, which is like big wides of the sets, like a construction person painting something, you know, things like that. You sort of just know what's needed to build a featurette like that. So yeah, so that would be a featurette, and then it could be a long form documentary, or it could be a Lord of the Rings 6-hour appendices. So,
and do they ask you to get all of that so that they can cut it together in any way they want, or are there films where they only want featurettes?
Yeah, I mean, most of the time you'll always be told beforehand, actually, if they want like an hour and a half thing, because that is a whole different ball game, because you just need like quadruple the amount of footage in order to sort of make that work. So for the most part, you go into films knowing it's going to be a short featurette, and then you've got to have footage for that. But even then, it's very much mentality of just shoot everything, shoot anything that's interesting, follow anything that wants to be followed. As in, like, you know, some departments don't want to be filmed all the time, and that's fair enough, because at the end of the day, like, I completely understand that while you're just doing your job, you don't want a camera in your face all the time. So, but then there are some departments that are super up for like constantly being filmed and things, and you find that's also how a featurette could be made, if there's a department that's quite open to you being there all the time and things like that. So yeah, it's sort of, would that answer the question?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And I think there's some, I guess every department really loves what they do. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of them get into it, especially in this competitive industry. So these are people who really want to be there. Mm. And so it must be really nice for them to show off what they're working on in those featurettes, because later on they can show those to their family and go, this was actually recorded this time, rather than on all the other films where that wasn't captured.
Yeah, and it's definitely like interesting. Like one that I always love filming is the puppet department and puppeteers, like, because they just always get super, because a lot of the time as well, they're actually CG'd over, you know, so in some ways the behind the scenes is their like time where they can be fully what the puppet is. So they'll always get very excited, and they'll show you through, and they'll talk you through the mechanics, and they'll start sort of playing up to camera, and, you know, and all those kind of things. I always do love when that kind of naturally happens, because I think really, like, also part of the reason I got into behind the scenes is because I love documentaries, and like, and I did do some filming on documentaries and things. I did one with Channel 4 and a few other ones, and that kind of fly on the wall, just getting those moments that feel organic. And sometimes, you know, you do need to construct things. You do have to be like, when's a good time that I can come over and ask you questions? And then you go over and you ask the questions and they sign off and things like that. But there is a sort of like magic to when you're just bouncing off each other and people just sort of naturally start showing things to camera and naturally start talking about things. So that's always interesting. And also there is that thing, especially like with that, like you said, it's like one of the times that they really get to show who they are. And then I hope that then it becomes something in the edit. But, you know, they also have lots of footage and things. So some things don't always sort of actually get made at the end, but it's always nice to just cover everything anyway.
There must be such an energy to capturing stuff on the fly.
Mm.
I know I've shot like short documentaries and stuff in the past, and the moments where I just have to get the shots because they're right there and they're happening and they look great were some of the like times in filmmaking that I felt most alive.
Mm.
There's a lot of filmmaking which rightly is a lot of planning, a lot of budgeting, a lot of, and so you kind of get to set, you already know what you're going to do, and everything goes well, it's going to happen. And if it's not going well, you're not exactly feeling alive because it's really hard.
Mm.
But yeah, that sounds so exciting to be able to just be like, wow, look at that prop going past, you know, the soundstage. Mm. And then go over and get the, you know, permissions and
yeah. And also like there's a very like quintessential behind the scenes shot, which I always find really interesting because it's like the least behind the scenesy shot, but it's like basically what the camera is seeing, but with a tiny sliver of the main unit camera in the corner, you know? So it's like, they call it like a clean shot because basically there's barely any like behind the scenes in it. It's just literally maybe like a tiny bit of the camera, but getting those shots, it's such like a minefield of like, you want to be somewhere where there's not lots of people, but you need enough people so it doesn't just look like a shot from the film. Because also that's not what we want in the department, because then it will just look like a shot from the movie shot on a worse camera. Because like, I don't have an Alexa, you know, with me or whatever. But also you don't want to get in the actor's eye line. You don't want to get in anyone's way because there's probably like a boom person just swinging around and moving and all this kind of stuff. So it can be a real like dance. And also like, behind the scenes people might not normally say this, but from my point of view, we're like very bottom of the food chain just because we're not making the actual film. So I want to make sure that I'm definitely not getting in anyone's way. And like, if anyone just needs to be like, even if I'm there first with my camera, it's like, if someone else just needs to be there, then I will just move and go somewhere else. So, but then after all of that, and then it all happens and you do get that like dramatic shot of like the actor turning around and then the main unit camera like slides in and you know, all that kind of stuff, I'm like, oh, okay, cool, it worked out. And then if you get it in one take as well, even, you know, you then get out of the way, and I think the crew respect that you're not like holding the space either, because it's, I think, you know, that's all a balance as well. Is like I said, crew don't want to be filmed all the time, they don't want a camera in their face all the time, so you do have to be really on it to like get your coverage and then leave to give people breathing room, or at least that's how I feel when I'm doing the job. But then again, depending on the job again, like Star Wars, it was like we were there all the time, like ready, and people and crew understand that, because I think everyone on that film just knows it's iconic and it all needs to be covered. So, you know, it's, every job is very different and it's always a bit of a balancing act.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you need permission to go on to the main, you know, for the main shoot? Mm. You have to get permission beforehand to get go on stage or in the scene?
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends, you know, different actors want different things from behind the scenes. So that's always a part of it. Normally out of courtesy, like when I start a job, I just go up to the first AD and just be like, I'm here. It's because, you know, I've had lots of like ADs come up and be like, right behind me and be like, what is this little camera in the corner? I'm like, you can just ask me, I'm behind the scene, you know. But it's because, you know, again, people, I think that's a common misconception, is that some people sort of liken it almost to paparazzi, like we're there to like catch people out and stuff. And I'm like, no. I was like, we're just making a documentary and I want to show everyone in the best light. And I think until people like have that and they see that I'm friendly and I'm just like, you know, I enjoy what I do and I don't know. I mean, maybe they've dealt with people that are a little bit more like that or something. And then it sort of all lightens up. But that's why you should get those like introductions out the way quickly, because I have had it as well, where I'm just like, interesting things start happening and then I start filming, but I've not really like introduced myself properly to everyone and everyone just gets a bit like, who's this, you know?
It ruins the shot for you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, oh, okay, maybe it wasn't worth it. But... So yeah, it's that's sort of like part of it. But most of the time it's all like, where before I'm even on the project, most of that like permissions thing and what it is, it's all signed off by production higher up before I kind of go on set. But there is always a balancing act, like I said, of like, I like to sort of say, try and read the room as best as possible, like the energy in the room of like whether I, and especially if I'm on a job like as an embedded shooter, which means I'm literally there every day for the entire shoot, like just filming every day, you get a real sense of the vibe. And knowing you're there every day, you can film less some days than other days, because you're like, okay, I feel like the energy's not good here. Everyone's stressed. Like, maybe the shoot's not going very well. I know I'm here tomorrow and they're on the same scene. So maybe I'll just like draw back and I'll go and like film the costume department or, you know, or something else. So it's a little bit of that as well. But yeah, it's all a bit of a balancing act.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. In like locations when you're scheduling with first, you have these little scenes that are like 1/8 of the page established show that could potentially be anywhere. And basically you'll leave them unfound potentially so that you can kind of slot them in as things change.
Mm.
And that makes sense that having those offset departments that you can go to them when you're like, okay, the energy on set, this isn't going to come across the best. Because if you did all of that, obviously the costumes change through the film and, you know, there's puppetry and there are various, but going through those, all those offset departments right at the start, you'd lose that flexibility.
And it's where it makes it kind of hard as well. Like, that's where being an embedded shooter is great, because it's consistent work and I know my schedule. I mean, it takes over your life and it can be a really intense like 4 months or something, compared to where maybe I'm just scheduled to be there every now and then. And then it's like, you know, you might have it that that's the only day that I'm there doing behind the scenes with a particular actor. So no matter what the mood is on set, I have to capture something that day. So then it becomes like another thing of just being like, you know, maybe I don't know if other behind the scenes people do that, but if I see like an argument or I see something, I'll like make a big song and dance about putting my camera down. So like everyone knows that like, right, the camera's gone this way. I'm not filming anything. So yeah, I try and do things like that, or like I try and make eye contact with people, and then because you don't want to be in a position where people are shouting at you to go away, which can happen. So I try and if I see things, I try and make eye contact, and then normally people are just like, you know, and then I go. So yeah, it's sort of getting those kind of ways of dealing with that when you're not embedded and you're like, right, I just have to get something today, so we need to figure something out. Yeah.
You get much chance to review the footage each day that you're recording, so you know what you've covered and what you might need to still get.
Yeah. So I do like shoot reports at the end of the day, and I DIT like back up my cards onto the hard drive. So normally as they're backing up, I'll look through things and just check everything's all right, because it's all run and gun. And most of the time I don't have an assistant, and like, you know, it was also, I've been on jobs where like the shooters have run around doing things and then like accidentally filmed, you know, interviews in slow motion, and, you know, and things like that. And so it's like, I like to go through and check. So then if anything is wrong, like we have time to then redo it and things like that. So yeah, I do that. And occasionally I do selects that I send back to like producers and things.
And for anyone in the audience who doesn't know the term DIT?
So digital imaging technician. I mean, it's really, it's not DIT. It just basically means backing up cards. I mean, I think if a DIT heard me call myself a DIT, it'd be like, or they would be like, no. But yeah, it's basically just like an abbreviation for backing up cards.
But there's a whole department on film sets and TV shows that's responsible for that.
Mm. Yeah. And then like digital imaging, they might also do a little bit of grading on set and things like that. So it's the actual role in a big film is much more than backing up cards. But for EPK, it's just backing up cards.
I saw you had DIT on your IMDb.
Yes. Yeah. So I actually, that was one of the roles that I did start off in. So I did it on really like independent feature films. And I also worked for a production company that did a lot with the JML teleshopping. So that was like one of my first jobs, was I was a camera assistant and a DIT. So I'd have to back up the cards and do shoot reports and sometimes do quick grades on them and export and transcode them while also being a camera assistant and doing a clapboard and all that kind of stuff. So that was why I was quite good at the kind of multi-hand. So I had that skill from then that I could take into behind the scenes. And, you know, in some ways it's like you could look back on that and I was definitely, you know, I was getting paid for one role, but probably doing like three, which, you know, isn't great. But the team that I was working with was so lovely and I loved working with them so much. And they were so kind with like teaching me how to do things that like, even with the knowledge that possibly I was, you know, wasn't doing too much for my role or whatever, like I was still super happy that that was my start kind of in the career, my career doing all that kind of stuff. Because also like they took a gamble on me doing, because I think, I can't remember, it was like, I just got a call sheet. I think I said I was interested in camera and I was a runner for them for ages. And I just got a call sheet and I was like down as a camera assistant on it. And I was like, okay. And then sort of went into that and like totally didn't think I was technically minded until they gave me that opportunity and then realized that this is like totally what I wanted to do. So yeah, that's kind of where those DIT skills were. And then thought maybe that's what I wanted to do to like earn money, because I want to be a filmmaker, but I want to find the thing that earns me money as well. So I was like, maybe it's DIT. And I did it on some of the big productions and things, but it was too singular. Like you're just in like a corner on your own, just like frantically backing up cards and pulling selects for people and things like that. And I think I wanted something that felt like I was a bit more part of the community of filmmaking and stuff. So I think that's why I then sort of went away from DIT.
It's quite fascinating actually in this industry that you do range in roles from small, maybe it's a music video or commercial or short or whatever, and you kind of are doing multiple roles all the way up to, I don't know, a really high-funded, high-end TV show that's got so much money that you kind of only have to do one thing in the day. But interestingly, when you start out in your career, a lot of the times we would do those first roles where we've got to do lots of things, be, you know, skilled everywhere, and then you specialize up.
And that's the thing. I think it was why, like, working with that company, like, they were so accommodating considering I was doing a lot. And actually, I then did go and work for other people where I was doing lots. And they were just like, but why is it not to the higher standard? And why are you not doing it quick enough? It's like, because I'm doing three things. So it's sort of like, I think it only works if there's some give that, like, you can't expect a Warner Brothers effort if I'm doing, like, you know, like that, a Warner Brothers or Lucasfilm standard of everything if I'm doing four roles as one person. So as long as there's that give that, like, yeah, like my handwriting might be a bit messy on the hard drives, or there might be some spelling mistakes on the shoot reports, but like I was doing a lot of other stuff. And that's why that company was good. And I think I realized that was why I was like, after I didn't, that company ended up going away, and I started trying to do that for other people, and they weren't as lenient. I was like, okay, right, I have to start specializing now in one thing. I can't go on to jobs unless they're nice to me and doing four roles. So
for EPK, you sort of alluded to at the start that for the traineeship, you obviously worked for a group of people and you alluded to the fact that there's a company that gets hired on.
Mm.
So is that always the case? Is every EPK team a separate company that's hired to do that whole thing, or do you ever get hired on just direct as a freelancer?
Yeah, so it depends. So like sometimes the actual studio is the vendor, so they're like in charge of it, or sometimes the studio hires a vendor, but I'm always freelance, so I'm always either hired by the vendor or directly by the studio. So that's sort of always how it works as far as I'm aware, as far as I've kind of interacted with. Yeah.
I hadn't realised before you spoke about the long ones with Lord of the Rings, but I know so many people in the industry who were inspired to join because they saw the Lord of the Rings behind the scenes, including Tom himself.
Mm. Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I love the Lord. I think I've watched the appendices more than I've watched the actual Lord of the Rings.
And it just must feel amazing that you're working something that can bring filmmaking to people in a way that the movie itself doesn't.
Well, I think that's always it. And I always try and be, you know, the job can get stressful sometimes, but then there will be a day where you're like following a food stylist as they like create sci-fi food. And you're just like, this is ridiculous. What am I doing? And what are we all doing? But this is very cool, you know. And also, like, you know, getting to be in production meetings and just getting to see like how different directors work and, you know, and how the crews interact and you know, how things are lit. Like and because I'm not present in doing that, like I don't have the stress of actually putting the light up. And my job is to watch and then film what I find interesting. It's like such an incredible kind of thing to just really take in exactly how a film set works. And, you know, and I'd been working in it for a little while beforehand. And even as a runner, you know, like you'd think, but I think I took the role of runner so seriously. I was like, I must have the teas and coffees ready. You know, it's like, I didn't even then get to really take in what it is.
So
and,
focused on that.
Yeah, exactly. Where like now I get to sort of like, it's my job to take it in and kind of think about the ways to shoot it and things. So it is pretty incredible. And yeah, and the appendices, I mean, I would love to make, like, I think they had something so special in New Zealand because they were just building a film industry. There was just like, you know, so much enthusiasm. I don't think you'll ever be able to replicate that, but it would be very cool to like work on
a 3-year job.
Yeah.
Did them all back to back.
So yeah.
Be embedded for 3 years.
Yeah. Which is crazy. I do wonder if it was the same shooter for the whole 3 years. There must've been other people that sort of jumped in and stuff, but yeah, that would have been a crazy one.
It's amazing. Cause it's like, people always say, I wish I was a fly on the wall in that, you know, room or whatever it is. And in a way you are in full respect, but you are, because you're there and you're capturing things and seeing things. And...
Well, that's definitely my, because there's a brand of EPK like shooter where you can sort of go in and, you know, like, I liken it to like Austin Powers, that like, you're like, hey, you know, you're sort of going in like high five, you know, and everyone sort of knows your presence and stuff. But I think because I'm more, you know, my kind of heart's in documentary and like you said, fly on the wall, I am very much more of a like quiet presence, you know. You can't be too quiet because then people think that you're sneaking up on them, and that's like a balance. But like, I'm very much just like to see how things happen and then occasionally pop my camera up and film them and things like that. So, and I just think you just, everything feels more organic, and I feel like people are more relaxed sometimes with that. So yeah, I'm definitely more the fly on the wall.
You get
kind.
That candid viewpoint of exactly what is happening on a set. It's not staged.
Yeah.
And I guess that translates for an audience. It looks real.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, definitely.
You're not sat on a roof somewhere with a really long lens.
Yeah. Although I have had to do that. Yeah. I'm like, right, it can't be out of eye lines anywhere. So I'm going to go really far away. It's like nature photography.
I wonder if, for someone who does, you know, as you say, it's not an entry level, but someone who eventually transitions in, what are the skill sets, well, I guess not skill sets, personality traits maybe, of someone who's really good at EPK?
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely at least skill set, you have to be able to juggle because you're doing your own sound. You don't have a camera assistant, you know, you're doing your own camera. And then when it comes to lighting, it's like, to interviews, you're doing lighting and sometimes you're doing sound if it's last minute. Like, you do have to be able to do lots of things. So I guess being able to do that and know exactly like, because, you know, some people think that because I'm able to do lots of things, it's like, what is the point of having a separate sound recordist and all that kind of stuff? And there's a huge point because it's like, it's all of them are very hard jobs. So part of the skill is knowing what the bare minimum is I can do in each job in order for me to make it work as one person. So yeah, there's definitely that. I would say, like, you know, it's like a lot of things. You have to be personable. You have to be like, for me, I think the skill that I've found is just really reading a room, you know, like really feeling like I'm like looking around and like thinking like, oh, how's everyone doing, without going up and being like, how are you doing? You know, like, because I think if I was asking that every morning, people would start to suss out. It's like, oh, you know, if I say I'm doing good, she's going to put a camera in my face. So I was like trying to find a way of sort of balancing with that. So yeah, I would say like a really good personality trait is just like being able to sort of read a room and sort of take in what's happening. And a skill definitely is just like, you know, because I was a runner for a while and things like really knowing how each department interacts with each other, and like when you need to ask for something, which department to go to and things like that. That's a very helpful skill, I would say, as well.
Could you give some examples of those?
So what was that? Yeah, so part of it as well is I can get a radio microphone radio feed for like lav mics and lapel mics into my camera, so knowing that I need to go to the sound recordist and maybe don't go directly to the sound recordist because they might be busy, so ask an assistant first who will then ask the sound recordist, and at some point that, you know, it will get sorted. As well, like knowing that like grips don't like people standing in their eye line when they're trying to operate and things like that, so sort of being spatially aware when I'm getting in position that I'm not standing where a grip might, if they're holding onto like a big crane, that I'm not in their eye line and I'm also not swinging, because people, you know, you can ask, but if you're like embedded and I'm there every day, they don't want you asking every day. So it's sort of starting to look at like sort of knowing when they're set up and knowing when they've done the blocking and all that kind of stuff. So then I know where to place myself rather than constantly going like, so where can I go then? You know, because there are people that do that. And that's a way as well, because sometimes that is good because it starts to build a relationship and a chat with the grips every day, which is good. But I kind of just like to sort of figure out where I want to go and do it in that way. So I guess there are a couple of examples of sort of knowing the mechanics of what happens on a set so you can navigate where you're going to put your camera to get behind the scenes.
When would you start as an EPK? Is your day one the day one of the shoots, or do you have a bit of prep time?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the shoot, I think if they're going for like a long form documentary, we're normally there a little bit before, like filming some of the sets get built, maybe doing like pre-interviews with the director about like, how do you feel going into this and all that kind of stuff. And then all the way through to like the end. So you know, there was like a film where I filmed like a volume capture day and then went in and filmed the scoring of the actual film and things like that. But for the most part, you just start around about the time. A lot of the times they actually don't want you there on day one if it's not like a big thing, because everyone's figuring out what they're doing on day one and don't want a camera in their face. So I find it normally it's like day three is when I'm then called in if I'm not there every day. So.
And do you get the full script?
Sometimes I get the full script. Again, depending on like how big an end product they want from the behind the scenes. You know, some productions sometimes have little excerpts of the script with things. I think, I'm pretty sure like the vendor that hires me always gets the script and then they can sort of pull from that and let me know things that might be interesting to film. But yeah, sometimes I do get to read the script, which is cool.
And if you don't get the full script, do you get the sides for that day?
Yes, I get a call sheet and sides normally. So I'll get a full call sheet of everything, which is good. And some sides, yeah. Although I don't... Yeah, I do. Yeah. Oh, sometimes they're not directly sent to me. They'll be sent to production and then sent to my producer and then passed on to me. But I'm normally always on there because people obviously want to know when behind the scenes camera is there. So,
yeah, speaking from my experience, it usually is a thing that goes around set ahead of time to be like, by the way, on Thursday, there's going to be an EPK that person coming.
Yeah.
And
everyone's like, best behaviour.
I'll look nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like being a teacher and being like, so Oxfam's coming on. Yeah. Hey guys, and you're like, understood.
Yeah. No, it is funny. And it's like some productions actually, you know, like if it is particularly, there was one production where if it's particularly stressful and then they want a lot of fun moments of the behind the scenes, I actually got like a nervous twitch when someone laughed because I was like, I've got to film it. I was like, barely anyone seemed like they were having fun on the film. And I was just like, I mean, it was a serious film, but you know, for some reason they wanted fun moments. So it's like every time someone laughed, I was like, ah.
That translates to your real life when you're sat next to a friend and they say,
yeah.
You,
oh, yeah. Just like phone. Yeah.
So I was wondering, you said, so some jobs you're embedded, which means you're there kind of pretty much every day.
Yeah.
Is that 5 days, 6 days?
Yeah, but it can be 5 days, you know, or 6 days. I mean, sometimes it depends if like the sixth day is anything that they find interesting. And obviously then budgetary things start to come in if they can afford to actually have me on the sixth day. But yeah, I mean, I've been there where I've literally been like 6 days a week. For like, there was one job that was almost 9 months long. And then towards the end, it was almost 6 day weeks at the end. So, yeah.
Because a lot of departments work weekends as well, because they'll take their day off in the week, maybe if they're like a prop maker or something.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, there's that. But also that particular production was just a little bit behind. So it was actually the shooting was 6 day weeks as well. Wow. So, yeah.
So my question was going to be, so on jobs where you're not embedded and you're doing featurettes, are you able as an EPK to balance multiple jobs?
Yeah, I mean, it gets tricky because, you know, like, because I'm probably there for that specific day because it's a stunt or because it's like something they really want covered. And then film schedules change. So then that day will change. So that's where it does become a little bit trickier. But I was, you know, you are able to balance it. And if you've got a good rapport with your vendor and your publicist, you can normally figure something out. So yeah, you are able to balance kind of other jobs. I'm kind of lucky now where I've bought a houseboat. So my living expenses are lower. So I actually try to not juggle as much and then just have some free time to like do what I want and things. I think, you know, I've given so much of myself to film now and like doing the 6 day weeks and the long contracts, I'm trying to find a balance of like not working as much, which is, you know, a real privilege to be in that place. Also the sacrifice of living on a boat. It's not a sacrifice, but it's a definite different living experience than living on land. But yeah, so I'm sort of juggling a little bit less. So I wouldn't be able to give a lot of feedback about that because I tried juggling and it was quite difficult. So then I just stopped and I was just like, I'll just commit myself to this job and then the days will just change and then that will just be what it is. So
we spoke to a number of freelancers and we asked them about how they balance things. Mm. And as you say, if you keep your costs down, definitely that's one of the benefits.
Mm.
But I don't know how much EPK pays, but is it a sort of case that you might do a 4 month job and then you could take a couple of months off and then you do another 4 months? And
yeah, definitely. I mean, it pays reasonably well if you have your own kit. So like I started off like in a little bit of debt because I financed a camera in order to earn a bit more money. So if you do have your own kit, it can be pretty good that you could just do one job and then, you know, take a break. But then the freelancer in me was just like, oh, if you say no to a job, then they'll never ask you again. And so then you end up doing four films back to back. And then that was, I think that was where I was like, okay, I need to figure out a mental way of being able to say no. So that was a struggle. And also it was because, you know, again, you have that thing where you work so hard to get to a position where people are asking you and like you've got almost like your choice of job. It's hard to then just say no to all of them because you want a break, which sounds silly because it's like, you know, you should be able to have a break. And then in that way, and, you know, because they're long jobs as well, you kind of almost are like on a PAYE contract, but without any of the benefits of sick pay or holiday pay because you are freelance and you're just working back to back. So yeah, it's all a balance, you know, and because like I said, I worked really hard to get to that place. And before that, I was just like doing one job and then not working for 2 months and like wondering where the next thing was, not by choice, just because for whatever reason, nothing was coming through, and then panic working for ages. And so it's very hard being freelance in that way. But then you do, you know, I have friends that do have 9-to-5 jobs, and it's allowing yourself to once you're at that stage where things is coming through, allowing yourself to have that freedom is then the next difficult thing to sort of overcome.
I think I've seen a lot with freelancers when they're first starting out, they think that if they're not working, they must be rubbish and no one wants to hire them. And there's this kind of constant sense of just take the work when it comes. And we also spoke to other guests about burnout and, you know, when you're working all those hours, having a life. So there's a whole lifestyle to freelancing that I guess you calibrate over time when you start out how to make it work for you and your sort of life.
And I think it's only something like you can have all the advice and everything, but it's sadly one of those things that's only when you start living it and find your own mechanisms for it is the way of finding it. You know, like my main one is just making sure I enjoy holidays, because like I'll book a holiday and then a job will come through and it's like, oh, you know, I've lost that money in that job and I've spent loads of money on holidays. I've lost double the money now. You're like, and then you're sat on holiday just grumpy and you're like, this isn't the point. So yeah, I mean, that was getting better with that now, which
so if you make it like it's a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Spending both those double bits of money because I want this holiday.
And I earn all the money before so I could go on this holiday. So, you know, it's good. Otherwise I'll be 50 and still not on holiday.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever gotten?
Oh, best piece of advice I've ever gotten. I think like one bit that, you know, I've always thought of is like, I can't remember who said it, but they said, just don't ever forget why you started in the industry. Because crewing is amazing. And like being in the circus of a big movie is incredible. And I feel very privileged to be there. But weirdly, on the other side of that, it was never why I wanted to go into film. It was always to make films myself. So like always remembering that each stepping stone was a stepping stone to that. Until I fully feel like I don't want to make films and I'm very much enjoying where I am, then I would let go of that. But even when I'm on these amazing sets and doing all that, I just remember I got into this because I was making horror movies when I was 9, you know, like, and that's still what I'd like to do. So I think that is something, because you do lose yourself in the circus of it and how amazing it all is and things like that. But, you know, I never get as much enjoyment from what I'm doing in EPK as I am when I make something. So it's about just reminding yourself of that even though that doesn't make me money and it's hard, that's also hard work. That is why I wanted to start. So,
yeah, I was supposed to say in the intro, you are a director in your own right. You've done your own shorts and you have a Kickstarter project on the go at the moment, which we'll touch on a bit later. So maybe we can transition over to that, but maybe let's start with, what have you learned from doing EPK and how can you apply it to making your own shorts?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing, I mean, obviously I've learned from all the directors that I've watched, like I did Mickey 17 that you mentioned earlier with director Bong Joon-ho. Like I was such a huge fan of all of his work and getting to see him work was incredible. And he works so, you know, I can't go into it a lot, but he goes because of NDAs and things, but he works so interestingly. Like he's just like no other director you could ever imagine. And just seeing someone do something so different and in person, because I also love Gareth Edwards and the way that he created the creator and things like that. I think I really, weirdly, it's made me like go onto big film sets and be like, I don't need any of this, you know, and just really think about like what I want and what I find interesting to help me make films, because not that I guess that's the wrong way to phrase it, that I don't need any of this, but it's like really looking at the departments.
Not part of your process.
No, exactly. Yeah. And like, see, because I'm never, and as in like, I don't need any of this because I'm never going to have £300 million to make a movie. And really looking at the departments and how they interact and how you can create a microcosm of that on your own films is probably a better way to phrase it. So that was definitely something that I've learned about, and seeing like the way that technology has changed and how cameras are, like getting to work with, yeah, I've got a Sony FX9, so that's what I shoot with, and just really getting to shoot every day with that and like really seeing how I can push the capabilities of that camera for my work and things like that. That's definitely a big sort of takeaway that I've had from doing the EPK work. And also, I think the biggest thing is just feeling like completely at home on a set. And I think that's the biggest thing that actually crewing can give you. Because I have fantastic friends that worked in bars and made short films on the side. And, you know, have now won like BAFTAs and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, working in a bar gives you time to make films. But I think the thing that I've mostly taken from crewing is just, I just feel like so at home on a set with a camera on my shoulder. It's like, it's just second nature to me. And I feel like that's why when I go into my own projects, like I just feel really comfortable when I'm shooting them. And I just think when I was just making, I mean, obviously I was a lot younger, so there was that as well. But when I was making films on my own, at the beginning and hadn't really had any set experience, just the whole situation just felt really alien and strange, and like how I have to interact with people and stuff, where now it's just like second nature. So I think that's not even just EPK, but just anyone, I think, that crews on sets, it just gives you that familiarity and that comfortable feeling when you take it onto your own projects.
It's one less thing to be stressing about.
Yeah.
You're not sitting there going, oh, what am I supposed to do there? What am I supposed to do that? You can just be like, okay, I'm here. I'm comfortable. Let me focus on the thing I'm trying to learn. Maybe it's the camera, maybe it's, you know, the sound or whatever it is. You can focus more on that skill set.
Yeah.
And not all of the sort of peripheral noise.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a good skill to have.
So you said you started, or you really started making horror films and stuff when you're 9.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people like start making films, end up in this industry, start making films quite young.
Mm.
Was that the first time you realized you wanted to make your own films and work in film?
No, weirdly, because I was like, filmmaking just wasn't, I feel like it's so present now. Like I was in the cinema the other day and there were like 3 adverts about getting jobs in films. And like when I was growing up, it wasn't a thing. I mean, in my mind, it was like theatre, but like in a tiny box, like all those people were in the box. And it's like, it didn't even cross my brain that there was like people behind that filming it. So I just think me making films when I was younger was just because it was fun and it wasn't ever like, oh, this is a career. You know, it was just, you know, I had one friend, Ellie, who, you know, helped me get into film because she was the only friend that would put up with me making her like crawl in the mud like from a monster or something. So yeah, like for ages. And actually because of that, because I had this sort of strange connection to that it was theatre, I was like, oh, I'll be an actor then, because that's how you get into it. So I like tried being an actor and I went to loads of acting classes and did like performing arts and all this kind of stuff. And then it came to actually like performing in front of people. And I was like, this is horrible. I don't want to do it. It's like, this is what it's like. I don't want it. But then that's when I realized when you do then see that and actually start seeing behind the scenes and things like that, you're like, wow, there's like a whole team of people. It's not, the actors don't just like appear on my telly. Like there's a whole team behind it. And then, yeah, I just did some Googling actually. I think, yeah, again, it wasn't even for film. I think I was just, so I actually left school when I was 16 and I did my A-levels from home. And I just wanted to like join a youth club. I just wanted to be around other young people because I was working in a bakery full of adults. And it's when I came across like the BFI Film Academy because it was like for my age group. And I was like, okay, cool. I made films when I was 9 and there's going to be other young people there that I can hang out with. And so it was literally that. It wasn't even like, oh, and then this will give me my entire life career. But that's exactly what I ended up doing. And, you know, I went there and I was like, this is everything I've ever wanted, you know. And then it just sort of spiraled from there. So I did the BFI Film Academy at the South Bank in London. Yeah
I think I remember I went to talk years ago and there were some sort of people in their 50s and they were really sort of chastising the BFI for not being supporting them as filmmakers. But actually you're right, it's changed a lot, and in the last 10-15 years that the BFI has all these schemes like the BFI Film Academy and various other ones which are helping young people realize their dream. I think because the industry's really been booming over the last 10-15 years, There was, especially during the COVID pandemic, there's a skills shortage and they needed people to know how to do this. It's just, there's a lot of sport out there for young people. And I definitely recommend checking out BFI Film Academy. I did it myself.
Yeah. No, they're a really good organisation. And, you know, they've got like, because they've become like more regional now, which is great. But I remember at the time it was only in London. So you'd travel to London and you'd have like Saturday ones where you could meet other like-minded filmmakers and just people. And it was just great for sort of building friends and building a network and really starting to like educate yourself on and what a career could be and like making it feel plausible. Because also like I didn't really go to... I did go to performing arts school, but all the other schools that I went to, I moved school a lot for various reasons, but they didn't really have any arts. So like there was just art and that was it. Like there wasn't drama a lot of the time. There wasn't even media or anything. So I just had like no clue about any of this stuff. And so, yeah, it was really great to see like an organization that was really pushing not only that it existed, but you could make a career out of it, because I just didn't have that in any of my education institutions.
Yeah, and I recommend the BFI Future Film Festival as well, which is a good one for young people who are looking to make their own films or just network with other filmmakers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing that you did the Film Academy because you wanted to be with other young people, and obviously they then love film as well.
Yeah.
So they're there.
Yeah.
So you kind of have that shared bond over that.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember at the time I hadn't really, like I said, I was working with a load of adults. I hadn't been with young people in a while, so it was like being there again. And it was like, yeah, it was very cool. I mean, I think, you know, I was, because of that, I was just like, once I'm in here, I was like, I'm going to make friends with everyone. I'm going to get every job. You know, it was like that thing of like, it just sort of lit something in me, which I think if you would have asked any of my teachers in school, I was not a dedicated student. But weirdly, when I got there, I was like, this is it. I'm dedicating everything to this. So
when you love something, it's so much easier to just apply yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What? So you did the BFI Film Academy regional one, and then you did what we spoke before, the Craft Skills, which is the sort of national one that's at the National Film Television School.
Yeah.
After you'd done that and you did a directing there, right?
Yes, directing.
You directed a short film. What were your next steps? How did you take that and transition it into eventually having paid work?
Yeah, so I kind of emailed all of my tutors after the Film Academy and all of my NFTS tutors as well, and just said, can I get any run of work? I also did loads of cold emails. So there was like, I did a 30-day free trial for IMDb Pro, and it means you get everyone's emails. So I just went through and like just made a list of like all of them. So I had them all in for when the trial ended, and just cold emailed all of them and did loads of stuff like that. And I think, I don't know if I did Facebook groups at that point, but anyway, a cold email came back. Someone came back to one of my cold emails just about doing some runner work, and I ended up getting a job on an ITV thing. And I just remember thinking, okay, right, I've just got to, I mean, I've probably annoyed everyone quite a bit, but I was like, only work experience, so technically they didn't want me to do a lot, but I was like, no, I'm doing everything. And now looking back on it, actually, I was like, knowing that the camera trainee normally makes the camera department's tees and the sound department trainee makes the sound department's tees, I just made everyone's tees. I was just like, anyone needs a tee. And really, I should have been prioritizing the actors, but luckily it was a show where the actors were like super lovely and very chill, so I would just make everyone's tees and would go around. And it was just like, you know, I think I would also like go, I did this, I don't recommend this, but when it's in radios, when you want to do like a direct note, there'll be like, Alex, switch to channel 2, because it's like a vacant channel. But even if it wasn't aimed at me, I would switch to channel 2 and see what they were saying and then see if I could like, and then like jump ahead to like try and help.
Don't say anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And don't say anything. I'm like, oh, right, they want this. And I was like, maybe if I get it quicker than that person, you know. And I mean, I didn't quite do it to that level. I think I would just go over and help that person as well. But I just really wanted to seem keen. And I think I definitely achieved that. So, and it did help. I mean, I got loads of work after that, and it just all spirals from then. It's like, once you get your foot in and you just really like establish yourself as someone who's very proactive. I mean, it was just something I actually always tell people is, even when like I'm not doing anything, I'll just go and like straighten stuff. Like I'll just straighten things and make it look busy, you know, like I'm doing things. And then someone will come over and it's like, I know you're busy. I'm like, yeah, I'm so busy, but I'll help you. And I'm like, what I'm doing is like straightening stuff. You know, it was things like that, which are really silly, like in hindsight, but I do think weirdly they helped me kind of get all those jobs afterwards.
There's been this weird transition for me. When I started out 10 years ago, I did like a Production Guild runners training thing. And they were like, you must never sit down as a runner. Never sit down. You must always be busy doing things. Never have your phone out, you know, those sort of things. And I'm dating myself, because now so much of film sets are run via WhatsApp.
Yeah.
That you could no longer tell if a runner was on Facebook or they were on the WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
So it's a weird transition, because I still kind of have that mentality I had 10 years ago, which is I'm always standing and switched on, and I really feel uncomfortable if I'm just told yeah, just chill.
Yeah.
Like, no, I can't chill. There's got to be something to do.
Yeah.
So I suppose, like, I don't know what the lesson is there, but I guess if you come onto sets now and you're much younger than I am, still try and maintain that element of looking busy, even if you are allowed to sit down and now look at your phone and whatever.
And I also think it's really hard on, like, really big, like, if you are able to get a job on a really big film off the bat, like as a set PA or a runner or something, like you could just be in charge of doing the red bell, you know, which is basically where someone flicks a button when they're recording and a red bell goes on and you flick it off when they've cut, so everyone knows not to come in the soundstage. And it's like, how do you look busy and keen whilst doing that? So weirdly, I think because it was much smaller sets, it was like soap operas and TV, small scale TV, there was actually more for me to do to look busy. And I do think, you know, like weirdly, then it comes down to just being personable and easy to get on with, which I think, you know, is a blessing and a curse. It means that technically, if you just get on, then that's great. But then it's a shame to not get hired because maybe someone's not vibing with you or something. So it's a kind of double-edged sword, but it's, yeah.
My trick to looking busy is just not to have my phone on.
Mm.
So obviously, I'm aware of WhatsApp, but also there's radio, so you don't have to rely on WhatsApp.
Mm.
But most of the time, other than maybe a quick check now on WhatsApp, but back in the day for sure, I would just basically not use my phone.
Mm.
I've mastered the art. If I'm given one job, looking like I'm loving that job more than anything else. Like, buzz.
Yeah, exactly.
Red light on.
Yeah.
Red light off.
Yeah.
Like everyone, if anyone ever turned and glanced at me, they could see that I'm sat there paying attention.
Yeah.
They'd flick that red light, you know, on as soon as they go, rather than being on my phone. Okay, we're going for a take. Oh!
Yeah.
And then there's a slight delay. Mm. If someone happens to be looking at me as I fumble, you don't look as great. And I don't know whether different people will have different tolerances for how much you use your phone, depending on who you're working for.
Mm. But
generally speaking, always be switched on, especially at junior level, so that you can keep progressing and maintain that reputation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So you obviously you love making films, and then you've started doing running, and you did a bit of DIT, and then you've ended up in EPK earning money. But your dream is to direct and make short films and feature films?
Yeah, I actually mostly made features. So so Rob Savage, he's a director now, has done some great things, but he was actually one of the tutors on my academy. And I just read somewhere that he made a feature film when he was 17. And I was like, well, I'll just do that then. and I made I'm lucky I have very cool parents and my mum's a boxer. So I had her as my subject for a feature documentary. So I did that and then making another feature. I just think I have made little shorts and music videos and things like that, but it's just something I really love about long form storytelling and like really pushing myself in that because it's just a whole different muscle. And also a lot easier in maybe people won't agree, but a lot easier in documentary than fiction to like make something long form because like you said, you're sort of following something as it's happening and you're figuring that out, where like writing down a feature script and the nuances and getting that.
Finding the story with documentary more so than you are creating it from scratch.
Exactly. So I feel like that's a lot difficult with fiction to do a feature. But yeah, so I did one about my mum and then now one about my dad, and he did a like pirate punk channel in the early 2000s. It was only up for like a couple of months, and he always thought it was a failure. But weirdly, I actually went on a film set, and then it was like a grip or a spark was wearing a t-shirt with a band from the channel. I went, oh, my dad had a channel that had that band on, and he went, what, not P-Rock? I went, yeah. And then we did searching. There's like this whole like community of people, like cult following, that just love the channel and stuff, and people have tattoos and things. So I was like, oh, okay. So then I was like, oh, I'll make a doc about that. So that's now the feature doc that we're making at the moment. So
that's amazing. So is that what your Kickstarter is for?
Yes. So that's the Kickstarter is for the punk documentary.
Yeah. I was going to ask you to pitch it, but that's such a great pitch already.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in, you know, that's all music.
And also like, so I've gone on to teach on my BFI Film Academy and things like that. And we had a little bit of money just to start making the production. So we managed to get the interviews in the first stage of animation. So this Kickstarter is just to finish it. But most of the people I've made it with are my students. So we've hired them like one as, and trying to do it in a way that, you know, they are doing more than teas and coffee. So actually like Grace, one of my students, she's like basically created the animation sections and like had lots of ideas and inputs, and an editor that we've come in. It's like I've said, you know, like, obviously I want you to organise the edit, but like write down your opinions and things. So sort of trying to make it collaborative with my students, because that's just one thing I want for them as well. It's like, obviously you're going to go off and crew and you're going to work on amazing films, and that's very cool. But like, it'd be cool if you have a space where you could also be creative. And I was hoping that this film would also sort of be that as well. So that's why I've tried to bring students on it. Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, that's it's so lovely to hear, because obviously we're creating this podcast to also help young people and hopefully help them get into the industry, and you're doing that in your own way.
Yeah,
with your film. And
no, and it's super cool, you know, like, because as well, you know, they're so enthusiastic and they've got such great ideas, and because it's like all me doing it, like I'm doing too much, so it's good to have people that you can bounce off of and things like that. And so yeah, it's a really cool thing, and I do. And yeah, and hopefully, you know, we'll get the Kickstarter funded. But I think, even, you know, the film will come out in whatever form. It just means if we don't get it funded, then I'll have to do more of the work rather than sort of outsourcing. But I just want to make sure it does come out. So then the students that have, you know, put in the work and made things for it, they'll have like a screening or something so they can see it on a big screen, which would be cool.
I wonder what you would tell those young students like Grace. What their next 10 years could look like. What advice would you give to them?
I would say, like, try everything. Like, don't feel like you have to figure stuff out before you try. Just try it. I feel like, not to get too deep and philosophical, but like school and things, it makes it feel like by trying something and it not working out and quitting it and trying something else is some kind of failure. And actually, really, that's all like getting you to the place that you want to be eventually. And also, like, it is totally fine, you know, to like also just sort of work in a bar for a bit while you figure things out, because it can be really stressful on film sets. And, you know, and if you're like, just want to dabble in it every now and then while you figure out what role you want to go to and then fully commit yourself to that role, that's totally fine as well. You know, like, because we all have to earn a living. So it's sort of like, you don't want to get stuck in something too quickly, I guess. So it's just about like being adaptable and being okay that, like, if you've done something and you've not quite enjoyed it, not to give up, just try something else is probably what I would say.
I suppose also maintaining positivity, and even if you're doing a job that you didn't enjoy, work hard and remain positive so that when you leave, you've not burnt bridges.
Yeah.
So that you can then go, okay, that didn't work out for me, but everyone liked me and they would work with me if I wanted to.
Yeah.
I'm now going to go try down that route because those people might have connections.
Well, and that's also the thing as well, is that there's a, like I said, there is a snowball effect, but there is also like, even when you've done one job, it is still up to you to keep that connection, is what I would say. Like, send people a text every now and, like, if you do want to get hired by them again, you know, send a text every now and again asking, how are you? Or like, you know, even Instagram, you know, write a comment on one of their photos or something like that. Like, it's all at that beginning stage. It's almost like you can't expect just that one job to definitely get you the next one. Like, if you do want the next job with that person, you have to like keep in contact with them and keep up a relationship, because it is all about relationships in the film industry. So yeah, I would also probably say that.
It's an interesting phenomenon, if you like, when you get towards the end of jobs where everyone's sort of looking beyond to see what their next job might be. And at that point, then your supervisor or senior might offer you something. They might say, like, oh, you know, I'm floating two or three different potential projects that I'm going to jump on, but I would love to take you on as my junior to one of those jobs. And you can sort of think, oh, yeah, that'd be fantastic. And I suppose at the same time, not rely on that just in case, because those jobs might fall through. So it's a whole kind of
juggling,
jigsaw, how to find work. I would say that as much as you can when you're still finishing a job, one thing that COVID kind of ruined a bit, but is not jumping off a job too quickly near the end. If you can, stay on it until the end, because that's what you've been hired to do, a job. There was a tendency during COVID for people to jump ship all over the place, and it's really not great for your long-term sort of career prospects, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why, again, it's like I say, like, you know, it's okay to then go and get a job at a bar. Like, if you've stayed on a job and you've missed that next job, it's not like a failure in any way to just maybe go and do something else and then come back to it once that job's come, you know, that you do want to do and that is well-timed and things like that.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.